Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, this is your host, Mike. I need to apologize. In the first 20 minutes of this interview, there's a little bit of static. However, we figured out the problem, and the vast majority of the interview is static-free. I apologize for this technical difficulty. Other than that, this is a fantastic interview. Pavan is truly a fascinating character, and his work is really important. I'm sure you're going to enjoy this. Thank you. Welcome to New Books in History, a channel on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Michael Vann of Sacramento State University. But please, call me Mike. There are many Orientalist stereotypes about Thailand. Known as the land of smiles to foreign tourists, they often comment on the calm and pleasant demeanor of a people seemingly adverse to conflict. However, these are superficial remarks coming from observers or visitors who fail to understand the country's language, culture, and deep social, cultural, and political tensions. Since the bloodless end of the absolute monarchy in 1932, there have been a dozen successful coups and a few more unsuccessful efforts, and the spilling of blood. From the Cold War to well into the 21st century, Thailand has wavered between democracy but more frequently military rule, with the Chakri dynasty's kings ruling over this political pendulum. Today I'll be speaking with Dr. Pavan Chapchawongpong, about his edited volume, Coup King Crisis, a critical interregnum in Thailand, out in 2021 with Yale University's Southeast Asia Studies. This collection of 14 essays by a variety of scholars focuses on the coup of 2014 and the complex relationship between the monarchy, the military, and democracy. The volume does an excellent job of giving the larger context to Thai politics. Pavan, a native of Bangkok, studied at Chulalongkorn University before earning his doctorate at SOAS, the School of Oriental and African Studies in London. He then served the Thai government as a diplomat in the Thai Ministry of Foreign Affairs for 13 years. Currently, he is associate professor at Kyoto University's Center for Southeast Asian Studies. There, he edits the Kyoto Review of Southeast Asian Studies. Pavan is arguably the world's most internationally prominent Thai dissident, penning critiques of the Thai junta for the world's leading newspapers. He is the author or editor of a number of books on Thai politics. Pavan, welcome to New Books on History.
Hi. I'm glad to be here.
Yeah, so it's a real honor to speak to you. I've been following your work for years, and again, you are a really prominent figure in terms of critiques of the Thai government. But before we get going and before we get into the book itself, would you please tell us a little bit about yourself and how did you go from doctoral student to diplomat to scholar in exile?
Well, that's quite an adventure, I must say. I started off with being a diplomat right at the beginning after I graduated from Chulalongkorn University. So I went into the Foreign Service in...
Straight after your undergraduate, you went in.
Yes, yeah. straight away in 1993. 1994, I'm sorry. Okay. Yeah, I became a diplomat in 1994, serving in Bangkok at the headquarters for about 2 years. Mm-hmm. And then I was dispatched to the Thai embassy in Tokyo to help out with the embassy affair, as we had to take certain courses in Japan. After that, I went straight to London to do my MPhil and also PhD. I graduated from SOAS in 2002. And because of that, I went back to the Foreign Service to continue.
Oh, so you did Foreign Service before and after your doctorate?
Before. And because of that, I mean, I have to sign sort of a contract with the Foreign Ministry, even though I got scholarship from the British government. So, I mean, the system is a bit too complex to explain. Mm-hmm. But I have to return to work at the Foreign Ministry and then stay in Bangkok for a little while. I went to my first and last posting in Singapore. So I served as the first secretary at the Thai Embassy, as we say properly, Royal Thai Embassy in Singapore for 4 years, during which time so many things had happened.
Yeah, in Bangkok. So what years were those 4 years?
2003, late 2003 until late 2007.
Oh, okay. So the coup.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. And I think that I could say that was a big turning point in my life, and that sort of responsible for a decision to resign from the Foreign Ministry.
So you didn't intend to become an academic. You were going to be a diplomat.
I must say that, yes, at the beginning, I don't think I wanted to move over to the academia. But now that, you know, I had my PhD, and I felt that this is not to press anyone with PhD, including myself. I became overqualified for the routine job at the Foreign Ministry. And I felt this more and more, especially when the coup took place in 2006. And we were instructed, you know, to inform the host country, in my case, Singapore, of the reason why the coup had to happen. And, you know, this basically went against my belief as a Thai people, also including, you know, my knowledge from my study as I look back to the problem and history of Thai politics. So,
as a diplomat, you had to explain the coup and sell the coup to
exactly.
to other ASEAN states and to Singapore.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, to put it in a proper context, I had to legitimize the military coup as we were instructed by the Foreign Ministry. I mean, but this is normal anyway, Mike, because even if you were a British diplomat, American diplomat, you know, you had to follow the guideline from the government.
Right. But I mean, it's one thing to go through a democratic administrative transition, and another to go through a coup.
Yeah, but I mean, toward the end, if you don't mind me adding a little bit, I mean, toward the end, it started becoming a conflict of interest because I was not sure whether I should resign from the Foreign Ministry. Mm-hmm. My family, they really wanted to see me becoming ambassador, you know, at the end of the road. But at the same time, I became so frustrated. So I did two things at the same time. Starting to write article for newspaper, both inside and outside of Thailand, being very critical at first against the government. That already a sort of conflict of interest. You're supposed to work for the government, and then you start to criticize. And then toward the really, really end of my diplomat career, I started to criticize the monarchy. That is something that was unacceptable, you know, from the viewpoint of the Foreign Ministry. Yeah, in many ways, I was obliged, you know, to resign.
That's simply too far. So at that point, you make the transition from being a diplomat into being a scholar, but you're not going to be able to get a job in Thailand.
Yeah.
So what did you do?
Well, I mean, one of my responsibilities at the embassy, because the headquarters sort of understood that I was keen on academic work, so they give me this assignment of attending a lot of, you know, academic seminar in Singapore, and we know that Singapore is sort of a listening post. You know, there's so many academic activities there, and they put me in that position so that I could attend a lot of seminars in order to write a report on what really going on in Singapore in Southeast Asia, and send back to the headquarters so that it could be distributed to our embassy around the world. to right. see, oh my God, what are they going on in Singapore? I mean, and because of that, I got to know a lot of research institute of Singapore. And that's when I got a new job. Yeah. through my connection. To cut long story short, after foreign ministry, then I moved to the Institute of Southeast Asian Studies in Singapore. And I had remained there from beginning of 2008 until 2012.
Mm-hmm. And then it was on to Kyoto.
Yes, because again, the pressure coming from Singapore government.
Ah, did you feel sort of you were at a dead end?
Oh yeah, definitely.
In Singapore?
Yeah. Because as I now taste, you know, the freedom that I never had in the foreign ministry. So it drove me, you know, to write more and more and more. And the more I learned about Thai politics, the more I became very critical, especially now that I felt I was free to criticize the royal institution in Thailand. Mm-hmm. And at first, I thought that you would be safe as long as you do not criticize the Singapore government. It is untrue. Because, you know, Singapore play this game, diplomatic game, of trying to please, you know, its neighboring country, especially in ASEAN, by, you know, not wanting any critical elements, you know, in the educational system of Singapore. So toward the end of my stay, around 2010-11, I started to run into problem with my office. You know, every now and then I would be called into the director room and then I would be scolded that, you know, I think you talk too much about this issue. I think you might have to tone down. I think you might upset the Thai government and you put me in a very difficult position. It's happened too often. Too many times. And I realized that maybe Singapore is not a place.
And then in Kyoto, you have more freedom, more intellectual freedom, academic freedom?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I moved there 2012. This is a place I used to stay before. I'm not saying that I love Japan that much, to be honest. but I'm grateful, especially when it comes to academic freedom. And I must say, you know, through my experiences, you know, working in Southeast Asia, being a student in London, and also, you know, being a fellow in all over the places, including in the United States, I have to say that Japan gave me 200% of economic freedom.
Yeah.
Even during the worst time in my life, you know, after the coup of 2014, when I became a refugee, Japan would never come to me and ask me to tone down, to do something else. Don't talk about the Thai monarchy. No, they would never say it, not even once.
Yeah. So, I mean, you just describe yourself as a refugee. I mean, with the 2014 coup, did you lose your passport? What were the implications for you being a critic outside of Thailand at that point?
Sure. I mean, the coup of 2014 was plotted. You know, I don't think, you know, this has been my main argument. It did not just happen, in order to respond to the Yingluck government. We can talk into more detail later, you know, if the listener would not understand that much. But what I'm saying, what I'm trying to say is that there are a lot of events leading up to 2014. So myself and other people, we have long been monitored. So they used 2014 coup as an excuse to punish us. So again, this is not something spontaneous, right? And also because of my long years of being, you know, the vocal critic, you know, of the monarchy. So after the coup on the 22nd of May, 2 days later, I found my name in the list of people who were called to Bangkok to have attitude adjusted. So they call this process attitude adjustment. I was very angry. But again, at that point, I thought, no, this could not be real. What else you could do to me, you know, because I am living here in Japan. Oh my God, I was so wrong to think in such a way, because they could do a lot more to me. When I rejected the call, I even made fun of them, you know. I'm sorry to have to say this, because I have a little pet dog, you know, a chihuahua, and he became a celebrity, in fact. So I just wrote on my Facebook that, "Dear General, thank you so much for the invitation. But I could not really go to Bangkok because I am in the middle of the semester. But may I send my chihuahua to represent me in Bangkok. Oh my God, you know, it drove them so mad. Especially with the Thai junta, you know, they don't want to be a joke. So because of that, a week later came second summon. Again, I rejected it. Then 2 weeks later, it came with an arrest warrant for criminal case. Then I start to realize, oops, this is no longer a joke. This is real. And then the beginning of July, they revoked my passport. That's it. That is the end of the road for me. Then I realized that I have to become a refugee in order to protect myself. So immediately, beginning of July, I applied for a refugee status with the Japanese government. And I have been a refugee since 2014 until now. So I have no Thai passport.
When's the last time you've been back to Thailand?
2 weeks before the coup.
Okay, so 2 weeks before. So,
yep.
Well, this plays, all of this, your personal history here plays into the history of this book, Coup, King, Crisis, Critical Interregnum in Thailand. And people who've been following the Southeast Asian and Asian Studies email list may know about this, but there's a bit of an affair, as they would say in France, a bit of a scandal around this book and the publication of the book. NUS, National University of Singapore Press, was set to publish it. As I understand it, you were very far along, really sort of at the 11th hour. Suddenly, NUS said, no, we are not going to publish it. Could you tell us about this affair?
Well, yeah, I proposed our manuscript, edited volume, you know, by 14 contributors. Anyone who work on Thai studies, they must be familiar with the names of the contributor, because
The big names are here. The big names.
Yeah, big name. And what I wanted to say is that, you know, if you're talking about, sorry to use this diplomatic term, crème de la crème, you know, cream of the cream, so you can find them in this volume. Why I say this, because I just want to say that this manuscript is of high quality. So yes, there would be no dispute, you know, on the academic merit of
and it had been peer reviewed.
Oh yeah, vigorous peer review. Yeah, and we passed the peer review with only, you know, obviously with minor revision. You know, as always, we come across that, you know, in this kind of process. So okay, I proposed this manuscript in August 2018. It took us about a year, you know, to went through the peer review and also to revise. And then I did everything I could to meet the guidelines, including updating the manuscript right until the last minute, because that was, I mean, we went through the election in Thailand as well in 2019, and NUS press editor felt that this book would be outdated so soon had I not included the election. So again, I complied with the request, and I agree with that. August 2019, I signed the contract. After August 2019, then we started to work on the typesetting, then the design of the book, the ISBN was issued, then the advertisement already went on the website.
Yeah, and it was listed on Amazon with
still there, and it's still there too. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But of course, the link has become inactive, but the link nonetheless still there. One day, I got a phone call from the editor, Peter Shopford, saying that, oops, you know, there could be some kind of pressure. So I'll get back to you in the next few days. There could be a decision to withdraw the planned publication. Oh my God, you know, I was shocked. And then that phone call actually came a few days later to confirm the bad news without giving me any explanation, only to say that there could be some kind of pressure. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I was totally lost. I was lost because, I mean, this manuscript, we have been working really hard, and then, oh my God, what am I going to do? Anyway, to cut long story short again, you know, through our friends, you know, in the United States, we managed to get through Yale University at the Southeast Asian Study Program. Mm-hmm. And then, we started to talk about this possibility. We had to go through a mini, peer review process once again, and then the book came out first week of January. And since I started the campaign against NUS Press, right. The reason I had to wait it for so long, because I just want to make sure that the book has to be out first before I started to do anything. Because if I start to do anything and it could once again affect, you know, the publication, the planned publication with Yale, then it would be another devastation. So I just want it to come out, and then the campaign was launched.
So tell us about the campaign.
I have been discussing with a number of professors. The best way to do is not to boycott NUS Press. So basically, in term of, I mean, boycotting, it could mean not buying their book, you know, refusing to have anything to do with NUS. No, we do not want to do it like that.
Yeah, that could inadvertently hurt the number of scholars that you would want to support, especially junior scholars, right?
Yeah, you are right, Mike. Yeah, this is basically the bottom line. We do not want to hurt other academics, especially younger ones in Southeast Asia. So we issue a moratorium, meaning that, you know, we will not review any book or manuscript for consideration of publication at NUS Press. And we will not submit new manuscript with NUS Press as well. So I wrote an email to about 230 scholars, predominantly in the Thai studies, but including other, you know, in the Southeast Asian studies. And the number that turned back to me was not bad. We had 111 scholars joining this campaign. And simultaneously, we also launched an online petition to change.org. And seriously, our request, I mean, I could say it's quite humble. Mm-hmm. The humble request is that because they talk so much about stakeholders in the statement of NUS Press, saying quite clearly that the last minute decision was influenced by stakeholders, and they put a full stop right there. Our request is humble. Just tell us who the stakeholders are, because this would create a transparency, you know, in the publication review process. Right. So that this would set a new standard, you know, so that we know what really going on.
Yeah, you know who the stakeholders are, right?
But then they have to say it. Yeah. You know, it's not us to say it, right? If they say it, then yeah, the moratorium could be lifted. That's it.
Yeah.
But okay. I have not got any response back from NUS since the campaign.
Has there been any statement from the Thai government?
No. This is a bit tricky, Mike, because asking me, you know, whether the decision really comes straight from the Thai government might be not. Knowing Singapore quite well, this could have been a preemptive measure on the part of Singapore.
Right, right.
Even though what I'm saying, right?
So, like a sort of almost a national self censorship, in order to facilitate relations between Singapore and Thailand.
What really disturbed me the most is that if you have that position, you could have told us right at the beginning that I'm sorry, but we are not considering your manuscript. Right. But then, you know, so we went all the way until the very end, and to be dropped at the last minute. I mean, this is very unacceptable.
And sure, there should be no surprise there. You are the editor. You are a known entity. You are very public intellectual internationally. The title of the book is Ku King Crisis. It's clearly going to be somewhat critical. So, yeah, that sort of very last minute reversal is really, really shocking. And you've previously edited a book on the 2006 coup, correct?
Yeah, because my life just, you know, revolve around the coup in Thailand and the monarchy. Yes, you're right. In 2000, the book came out in 2014, but that book was about the coup of 2006.
Right.
Whereas the current book is about the coup of 2014.
Right.
I'm so
right.
Sorry for the listener here, but you know, in Thailand, things are like this. You know, we have to talk about so many coups.
Yeah. I'm an American, and we're getting used to that this week. Although
I
saw a funny text message that someone had posted on Twitter from a Thai friend telling their American friend that they really weren't very good at coups. I could do a better job.
Well, I mean, you can do a study tour in Thailand.
I'm sure.
Right?
I'm sure the incoming administration would love that, yeah.
Yeah. Right, I mean, that book that you mentioned also, talk about 2006 coup. But I have to say that when it comes to put the monarchy in focus, the latest book, we discuss more on that. And also because the role of the monarchy, you know, in the past decade has become much more visible. So it gives us sort of good material about the role of the monarchy. I mean, anyone who studied Thai politics and then, you know, not talking about the monarchy, you basically would not understand the development back in Thailand at all.
Well, hey, this feeds right into my next question. You're a joy to interview. You make this so easy for me. So tell us about Thai politics. And what I would suggest is that we go through some of the key players and institutions. If we could talk about the king, the army, the political parties, Thaksin. Let's start off. Tell us what is the role of the king and of the monarchy in contemporary Thai politics?
Well, I mean, this is such a big question. And I think, you know, to do a complete job, you might have to give me 2 days.
I'll give you 4 minutes.
No problem. Well, I mean, you introduced right at the beginning about the abolition of absolute monarchy in 1932. We have to say that right after the 1932 revolution, we saw the declining power of the monarchy. So at once, for one, we thought that this is it. This would be really the end of the royal institution in Thailand. But again, the People's Party, basically the group of military and also intellectual who formed this revolution group, they also have been very unsuccessful in strengthening democratic institution in Thailand. In the 1930s. Yeah. So that's why we came to the dilemma here. You know, we have on the one hand declining monarchy, but on the other hand, there should be more opportunity for democratic institution to be strengthened. But again, we fail. I mean, it could come down to sort of internal fighting among the People's Party as well, mm-hmm. right? So in some way, this started to open up a new opportunity for the king to revive the institution.
Right. But right? When the previous king, Rama the Ninth, came to power in the 1940s, the monarchy actually wasn't very strong at that point.
No. I mean,
and also the family fortune wasn't.
No, yeah,
it wasn't fabulously wealthy in the 1940s, correct?
Exactly. They were at the brink of collapse. So the power of the monarchy that we have seen from then until now, it really came down to one man, and that is King Bhumibol Adulyadej. So who, as you yourself said, you know, came to power in 1946 accidentally. I would not go into much detail because this is another big issue.
That's the issue around what happened to the previous.
Anyway,
issue.
I have a book coming out on this subject, you know, toward the end of this year.
Okay.
Maybe you can invite me back sometime later.
Okay. Yes.
But it's just enough to say that because of that accident, you know, his brother, King brother, was shot in the head. So Bhumibol became an accidental king in 1946. But then it took him about a decade in order to sort of stand up and then start to realize that, oh yeah, you know, there's a lot of things that king could do when it comes to re-strengthening the position of the monarchy. And we started to see from around 1959 onwards, you know, the rise of the monarchy in the political domain. The king started to work with military strongmen. And back then, you know, we have this field marshal, Sirit Thanarat. There's a few things that they did in order to bring back the glorious days of the monarchy. And one of the things, basically, they launched a neo-loyalist campaign in order to elevate King Bhumibol to be sacred, to be popular, and to be democratic. So to be democratic, basically, this is to give way for Bhumibol to intervene in the political process occasionally. And always, his intervention quite often ending political conflict, political deadlock, to the point that he had been extolled as a stabilizing force in Thai politics.
Right, and this the development of this alliance between the monarchy and the army leadership happens in the 1950s, grows in the 60s and 70s. This is in the context of Cold War Southeast Asia, where the United States wants to cultivate anti-communist strongmen, be it Marcos, be it Lon Nol, be it Suharto, correct? And this is so this fit the pattern there that there is a not to deny Thai agency in this issue, but there's also at the time of the growing American war in Vietnam, there's money coming in, there's support for the military in an anti-communist bloc, correct?
Well, yes, correct, Mike. You would not be able to talk about the rise to political prominence of the monarchy without the role of the United States. I mean, they all came together. We can say that there were three major actors here: Thai monarchy, Thai military, and United States. And the Cold War provided a useful context, you know, for these kind of alliance to blossom. The military relied on the monarchy. Likewise, the monarchy relied on the military. And basically, they used the discourse of national security, you know, in order to build up this alliance. The monarchy has been made equal to national security. So for the military to defend the monarchy was equal to defending the nation itself. And what would be the threat to the monarchy and the nation? Communism. That when the United States came in. And as we know, the United States, you know, they're not always here to promote democracy. In fact, they would promote any regime that would sort of give back the political benefit, you know, to the American administration. And by working with the Thai monarchy and the military in painting the image of the communist serve everyone well, you know, in this kind of alliance. Just very briefly, internally, we're talking about communists. In the form of Communist Party of Thailand, in the form of leftist student at Thammasat University. So that's why there was the tragic event at Thammasat in the 1970s twice. Externally, the United States, you know, used Indochina, Vietnam, Laos, and Cambodia to be sort of the face of enemy that would give legitimacy to the despotic regimes in Thailand. So everything come together right until the end of the Cold War.
So let's fast forward to the 1990s. And the Thai economy is doing fairly well in the early 1990s. It's one of these sort of economic miracle moments. And then the Southeast Asian economic crash hits. And it really starts with Thailand and famously spreads to Indonesia and leads to the fall of Suharto. And then one of the consequences of that economic disruption is the rise of Thaksin and his Thai Rak Thai party, correct, in the 2001 elections?
Yes. Well, the financial crisis, again, provided a useful backdrop to understand Thai politics in the subsequent decade. 1990 ended, you know, quite positively toward democratization process, even though at the beginning of the 1990s, we had military coup, we had bloodshed, crackdown on Thai protester in 1992. But after that, you know, this was the period when we started to see the growing democratization, ending with the constitution of 1997. To date, we still consider that constitution the most democratic of all time.
97?
In 1999, mm-hmm. Yes, correct. But it had been thrown away, of course. But that constitution of 1997 paved the way for Thaksin to walk into Thai politics, and then riding on the possibility of democracy, Thaksin somehow won election in 2001, landslide election, on the impressive populist policies. So he transformed the marginalized north and the northeast region. These are the most poorest region of Thailand, you know, into
East Isan.
Isan, yes.
Northeast, and then and also further north. And that's
true.
He's from the north, isn't he? Is he from Chiang Mai area?
He's from Chiang Mai, yes. He's from the north, and of course, an even poorer region is Isan or northeast. So Thaksin had this in mind that in order to win majority through the electoral process, if you could win hearts and minds of the marginalized people, the North and Northeast, the eligible voters combined happen to be the majority anyway. So if you could win that, then you win everything. And Thaksin was right. So
what were some of his populist policies? Famously, there was the healthcare clinics where for 30 baht or something, you could see a doctor, correct?
Yes, true. I mean, there's a lot of policy coming out of the populist project of Thaksin, one of them, the universal healthcare. But I think to sum things up, I think it's better to put it this way. I think he offered those marginalized residents a kind of political and economic belongings, through the electoral process. So I think for the first time, the rural residents felt that, they could control their own fate, and also they can lay their trust, in a political party. It means that, that if you vote for this party, you will get something back. This is something that's quite unusual. Yeah. In the Thai political context.
In your book, Kukin Crisis, that we're talking about, it's theorized as a struggle for recognition, correct? That,
yes, definitely.
To make the rural Northeast visible. The ethnically distinct region that, has a lot of poverty. And then if those folks are in Bangkok or in the tourist industry in the further south, works are the lowest level jobs, they're sort of the bottom of the economic ladder. But this was a way for them to have a political voice, or at least to be seen, correct?
Definitely. And Federico Ferrara, who wrote that chapter, explained really well of the idea of the problem with struggle for recognition. So I think these people, they felt that no matter how much they work toward the Thai economy, they would never be recognized, right? Because they know that for them to be recognized, they have to step up into becoming a higher class. I'm not talking about high class, but they have to jump from lower class into a sort of middle class. This is again political science 101. Once you read that position of being a middle class, then you start to see democracy at play. And Thaksin wanted to make things happen. Middle class in Bangkok felt uneasy about it, because then, if these people, marginalized people, manage to climb up the ladder to becoming an equal middle class, it would become too crowded for them. You know what I mean? So,
and is there a bit of ethnic or regional resentment as well? I mean, the central Thai is different from Isan.
Yeah, definitely. So the struggle for recognition is not just about economic recognition, but it's also going to political ethnicity, where you are from, what you representing. To say that Thai people are, one of the most racist people on the planet, then I would agree with that statement as well, especially middle class, Bangkokian, they have certain perception about what's supposed to be Thai, what's supposed to be representation of politics. And unfortunately, those from a marginalized region, they have not been recognized as one of, those who representing Thai-ness.
So what, just to circle back, what is Thaksin Shinawatra's sin then? Is it sharing the wealth with the lower classes? Is it giving voice to the excluded? I mean, it's this is all very ironic, because he's made billions in the telecom industry. I mean, he's not a poor rice farmer himself.
Yeah, I mean, it's quite ironic, but among the worst policies of Thaksin, we can talk about horrible policy of Thaksin, the South, and also war on drugs.
The repression in the Muslim South and the brutal war on drugs, which in many ways prefigured Duterte, right?
Yeah. I mean, we learned the pattern and platform, for Duterte of, 2020, 2021, the Philippines sort of following the footsteps of Thaksin. But if you put that aside, there's some credits to be given to Thaksin. And as I said, Thaksin tried to elevate, the livelihood of the North and the Northeast you know, so that they could be able to control their own political and economic fate. And that thing, I must say, Thaksin was very successful. He was so successful that he won second election in 2005, an even bigger landslide than 2001, making him the only prime minister after, you know, 1932 to be able to serve a full four-year term. This is incredible. I mean, in terms of statistics, it's already incredible.
And he's winning with a bigger landslide the second time in 2005. Yeah.
That's why.
So right, how are they able to launch a coup on him with that kind of popularity?
Because he became so popular that he started to scare the network monarchy. You know, we have not talked about the network monarchy, but this is network basically putting the monarchy at the center, supported by key non-elective institutions, military, judges, big businesses, including, you know, Bangkok, middle class, and also royalists. So they started to feel, as I said at the beginning, the competition from the marginalized region. So that's why the success of Thaksin in 2005 was really a wake-up call, you know, for the political elite that maybe Thaksin has to be eliminated because he had become too popular. So the anti-Thaksin protest started almost right after Thaksin winning the election in 2005.
I remember this as actually before I'd actually been to Southeast Asia many, many times in the past 30 years, but I had not been to Thailand. But I was on my way to Cambodia in 2005 and had one of these awful flights where I got into the Bangkok at 1 in the morning and had to fly to Phnom Penh at 6 in the morning. And so I just had to sleep in the airport. I was trying to find a newspaper to put over my eyes. And it was a local paper talking about the possibility of this coup coming. And it was the first I'd heard of this and really by chance. But he's overthrown in 2006. There's a junta in charge, but then democracy is reestablished. An election is held. And who wins the next election?
Well, I have to say that after the coup 2006, Thailand, you know, had never been the same. Yeah. I mean, if you really want to talk about, you know, the beginning of the deep crisis in Thailand, then maybe we should start at 2006. Because what we have seen afterward was nothing really about democracy. After Thaksin, the network monarchy placed a military man, General Suriyut Chulanon, to serve as prime minister. And he stayed in power for about, or just a little bit over a year. Now, little did they know that they would not be able to get rid of Thaksin, because Thaksin's influence was also much entrenched. So just for them to remove Thaksin from power, they quickly believed that they were able to get rid of Thaksin. So that's why they were confident to organize a new election by late 2007. And then Thaksin proxy won an election. So that would be another slap in the face of the Thai elite.
Is that when his sister won?
No, not yet.
But a proxy.
Proxy. That then lead to another crisis, deep crisis in 2008, when two proxy of Thaksin were also eliminated, you know, through the intervention of the court. Again, this would be a new chapter in Thailand.
When we started
to discuss the impact of the judicial coup. And then I mean, not to mention that a mini war with Cambodia over the Prayer Vihear Temple in the middle of 2008, the crisis and the conflict with Cambodia was politicized for the purpose of Thailand domestic politics.
Yes, I actually visited Prayer Vihear a year and a half ago with the Cambodian archaeologists, and they said, "Oh well, when there's political trouble in Thailand, that's when we get nervous over here."
Oh, definitely. I visited, you know, just only a year after that war. I have to say the term war because there's a large number of casualties and death.
Yeah, the soldiers. Know? It's the rank and file soldiers that suffer. Yeah. Yeah.
And then this become a stain, you know, in ASEAN, because ASEAN like to claim that after, you know, so many years without the constitution, until there was ASEAN Charter, you know, in 2007 or 2008, something like that, you know, there had no been major war among members. But here we go. We have a mini war here between Thailand and Cambodia.
Yeah. So then, what year was Yingluck Thaksin's sister elected?
2011.
2011.
Yep.
And then she governs until 2014, which is the coup in the title of this book. So what happens in 2014?
Yingluck was very popular. She came out of nowhere. People know that, you know, she was sister, youngest sister of Thaksin, but otherwise we knew little apart from being a successful CEO, you know, of a telecom company. But then over time, after 2011, she had proven to be a very charming prime minister. I'm not saying capable. I'm not saying that she was not capable, you know, but she has certain charm, you know,
she has charisma.
Charisma, exactly. Yeah. And then Southeast Asian politics, you know, one thing, you know, is also based on charisma, you know, and leadership.
Yeah, the charisma play and superficial things play no role in American politics. We're very much about policy.
of course. But that is secondary.
Yes.
What secondary was Yingluck's sort of leadership and charisma. That was secondary. What was primary was we were approaching the looming end of the Bhumibol era, because King Bhumibol, you know, as sitting on top of the political structure, right, within the network monarchy, he was hospitalized from 2009. And after that, in and out hospital, that started to bring up a sense of anxiety among the political elite. They started to wonder, you know, should Bhumibol not be here, whether their political interest would be defended and by whom, whether they can trust the new king.
But there was a clear successor that was designated. There was no surprise in succession. What's the problem with the heir apparent, with his son?
The problem is that there's no other alternative, mm-hmm. you know, apart from this unpopular crown prince. That's why they became even more nervous and anxious. And especially the rumor that, you know, the incoming king was too close to Thaksin. Mm-hmm. So they fear that, you know, had Yingluck and Thaksin been in power during this critical transition, the network monarchy, the military, the judges, they would lose all the political benefits, you know, to Thaksin. I think they, in their mind, it seemed to be operated, you know, the mindset seemed to be operated on the basis of the winner takes all, zero-sum game. So they fear that should Thaksin be here during the transition, and Thaksin would take all, and there's nothing left for other stakeholders. So because of that, they strove to control royal succession. And when I said that the coup 2014 was plotted, I think this has been a long plot for them. You know, from the moment that Yingluck came to power in 2011, and her popularity was basically non-stop, right?
Mm-hmm,
and then maybe it's time to eliminate her. And then when she was overthrown, you know, in 2014, that was during the period that Bhumibol was seriously sick, ill, you know, bedridden.
Right.
And 2 years later, we know that he passed away.
Yeah, so he passes away in 2016?
October, yes.
October 2016. And then that starts the... this process in the book, or well, maybe when you use the term interregnum, which you use the term from Gramsci, correct?
Yes.
This famous quote about I forget the exact quote, but the old isn't quite dead, but the new isn't quite born yet. We're in this complicated space between these two, and that's how you theorize these years, really, from 2011. To 2019,
yeah, that served as an important framework for this book, The Interregnum. The old has already died; the new one has yet to be born.
Forgive me.
No worries. I mean, he's long dead. You know, 100 years ago. So I'm talking about Gramsci. So So exactly, you know, whatever we saw during the Bhumibol era that has been so successful, you know, when the monarchy served as stability, political stability, that system had died. It was dead. Yet at the same time, we came out of the Bhumibol era, but yet we have nothing else because the democratic process, the democratic institution that Thaksin, and now the Future Forward Party wanted to set it up in the post-Bhumibol era has not yet been successful. So we are in this period of not knowing, the unknown period. That's why during this unknown period, whatever had been swept underneath the carpet started to come out.
So in the section three, we look, the book looks at several of the institutions, military rule, militarized monarchy, the khakistocracy, the courts, and also the Sangha, or the Buddhist monks. Could you say a few words on that?
Well, I mean, when I started to sort of frame this book, I wanted to bring about, you know, key issue that has sort of represented the crisis during this interregnum. And I came up with the problem with the military, with the judiciary, with the economy, and also foreign affairs. And one of the things is basically crisis in the Sangha, or basically the Buddhist monastic order, you know, during this period. There's a lot of competition, power struggle within major Buddhist sect of Thailand. Now, mm-hmm. It has become an issue because, you know, under the patronage of the monarchy, you know, Buddhist or the key Buddhist sect sort of has to follow, you know, what the monarchy come up with, a kind of religious Buddhist order. I try not to make it too complicated, but the highlight here is that without Bhumibol as that source of stability, not just only in politics, but also stability in Buddhism, without Bhumibol, you started to see conflict among major sects.
Among the different Buddhist sects.
Exactly. Yeah. And then this chapter picked up Tamashio, which is a very popular Buddhist sect, you know, to talk about the crisis that emerged from the absence of the Bhumibol influence. So this is to demonstrate that, you know, the end of the previous era, the end of the old regime, bring about new crisis. And we don't even know how to handle the conflict with the Sangha. And it has been left unattended, unresolved. Because with the Tamashio, you know, the head of the sect sort of ran away.
There's a military raid. Several raids, right?
And then, so dramatic. But at the end, we got nothing out of it. You know, we did not really talk about the reform of this key Buddhist sect. We don't even know where the leader of the sect is right now. So, I mean...
Is he still in hiding? I mean, it's been over a year, right?
More than that. You know, he still has been in hiding. So, so I think this chapter, you know, demonstrated really well the discourse of interregnum, especially, you know, whatever we've seen in the Buddhist faith among the majority of Thai who are Buddhist.
Right. And the as Gramsci said, and you corrected me, the new has not been born yet. We're still seeing how this will work out. And and same with the courts. The fourth and final section looks at the opposition to the junta. And there's essays on trials, freedom of speech, and on the internet, and self-censorship, and also the co-option of some of the NGOs. What are some of the most important issues here in terms of the attempts at opposition to the junta?
Okay, briefly, this section deals with a persistent culture of impunity. Culture of impunity is a big thing. It's a big debate in Thailand. You know, the state use of violence against the people, you know, from the 1970s at Thammasat, 1992, the Black May, and then 2010 against the Red Shirt. No one has been brought to justice. And I think Tyrell Habergon, you know, from Wisconsin Madison, deal with the issue of the junta after 2014 and the junta attempting to use the same tactic of employing violence in order to suppress dissent voices. So this chapter is about, we talk about, you know, the culture of impunity, including by David Stratford, also very interesting on the new culture of self-censorship and the incompetent civil society, you know, the last chapter. So while some of these troubles predated the interregnum, I have to say that the issue with NGO, for example, you know, it did not just happen during the interregnum. We have this problem long before, but they were exacerbated, you know, during the transitional
period. And accelerated too.
Exactly.
Right,
exactly.
Under the end of the coup. Yeah.
Yeah.
And in this chapter, what I was struck with is like so many similarities to just across the border in Cambodia under Hun Sen, or to some aspects of Indonesian politics. And in your chapter on foreign policy under the junta, you talk about the alignment. There's Thailand and China, and sort of an alignment of authoritarianism, but also some sort of authoritarian solidarity with Burma, Myanmar, and also with Cambodia. Could you say a few words on that chapter?
Well, this is a very scary trend in Southeast Asia. When I use this term in my chapter, illiberal forces in Southeast Asia
illiberal forces in Southeast Asia.
Yep. Illiberal forces in Southeast Asia started to come together and form an unofficial loose consortium. You know, if I want to use that word. Basically, this regime, semi-democratic, semi-authoritarian, giving each other, you know, legitimacy, recognition, so that it would also give them, you know, confidence in dealing with opposition in their own party in a ruthless way, knowing that, you know, even if you do that to your own people, there would not be a kind of contest coming out from your neighboring country. And in this case, you know, you can talk about ASEAN as well. So for me, I think the cooperation between Thailand, Myanmar, Cambodia, and on top of that, we have China, created, I call, a large hole in Southeast Asia, damaging democratization process, which ASEAN has claimed to champion since the establishment of the ASEAN community.
Right. And recently I interviewed Sebastian Strangio on his book on China and Southeast Asia, and he details the way in which, for example, the Chinese intelligence helps Hun Sen regime track down people on social media and so forth. So they're,
well, I mean, Thailand doing the same thing with China too, right? Sending a refugee back, you know, to be prosecuted in China. So that's why I have been warned not to travel to China, because I could be sent back, you know, to Thailand.
You could be seized and expatriated from there. Sure. Yeah.
I mean, you're talking about Sebastian, you know, he's a good friend of mine too. And then just a mini promotion that we are reviewing that book of him and to be a feature in the Kyoto Review Southeast Asia very soon.
Oh, good. I'll look forward to that issue. I had a wonderful conversation with him. I thought he was fabulous.
Correct.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much. You've been really generous with your time. But before I let you go, I've got just two more questions. Can you suggest two books for the audience to read?
Yes. As a Thai scholar, so I mean, I picked two books on Thailand. So
okay,
I
hope wonderful.
That, I hope that, you know, listener might not think that I'm a bit too narrow-minded. The first one, in fact, two of them recently released. And the first one in particular, I really like it, by a younger Thai scholar. And this book called Royal Capitalism, Wealth, Class, and Monarchy in Thailand, by Ajahn Puong Chon Utchanam. So very briefly, this book examines the hegemonic status of the monarchy. It focuses on dominance as a cutthroat capitalist. You know, it's also argued that the constant reinvention of the Thai monarchy was its remarkable asset, you know, that powerfully shaped the political and political and economic structure of Thailand. So in short, this book deals with the wealth of the Thai monarchy. You know, unfortunately, we do not have time to talk about the power of Ibu Roh.
There's great information in Ku King Crisis on that.
Exactly.
And for those who aren't familiar with this, the holdings of the monarchy, and is it the Crown Property Bureau?
The Crown Property Bureau. Yes.
Just astounding. I mean, the amount of wealth is even more shocking if you know the history that in 1945, 46, the monarchy was almost broke.
True.
And then becomes this incredibly powerful force in the second half of the 20th century.
Well, just one last sentence to finish off this book.
Yeah.
That the wealth had made the current king, and in fact his father, the richest monarch on the planet. With a net worth of up to $60 billion. That's got to prove that this is really a true, as he himself said, cutthroat capitalist.
And that's more than the Sultanate of Brunei.
Yes, of course. Oh,
yeah.
Oh my God! Okay. You know, uncomparable. No, you can't. Okay. You can't. The other book, you know, by a well-known professor at Cornell, Ajahn Thak Chelum Thirana, and then his book is Read Till It Shatters, Nationalism and Identity in Modern Thai Literature. This is also an issue that is close to my heart, because I was doing my PhD on a sort of Thai national identity on Thai foreign policy. So this book asks, what is Thai identity in the age of modernity? So in itself is, I mean, the question is already very interesting. So just ask, you know, what really Thai and how Thai-ness could live with modernity of the 21st century.
And what's the title one more time?
Read Till It Shatters, Nationalism and Identity in Modern Thai Literature, published by ANU Press in 2018.
Okay, I'll look forward to those two. And then finally, what are you working on now, and what can we hope to see from you next?
Well, my life seemed not to be able to run away from the monarchy. That always put me in trouble. So I have two current projects involving the monarchy, and I'm so excited. One is another edited volume coming its way. I will make sure that I will not submit it to NUS Press. So this book is about King Vajiralongkorn Rama X or Rama 10. This would be an essay of 10 scholars from various aspects of the current king, you know, from a biography of the king, from kingdom of Fia, from his reputation overseas, you know, from his relationship with the military, you know, from the Crown Property Bureau also, and including his wife, plural, wives
something yes, like that. Yes, yeah. Yes.
Okay, I mean, basically, this would be a lot of aspects of the current reign in Thailand.
Yeah,
the other project.
It's a fascinating topic, which in this current book, Ku King Crisis, there's quite a bit on him, which we didn't have time to get to, but it's...
Definitely, yes.
Wow, it is some very intense and complicated issues that come up, shall we say.
The other one is the Thai monarchy and the United States. Mm. And I have completed, you know, my field work at NARA in Maryland just before COVID, and I got all the documents. So this would trace the relationship with the Thai monarchy in particular and United States from 1823. That when, if I'm not mistaken, I'm sorry, that would be the year that we signed the treaty between the two country kingdoms. Mm. And making us the oldest allies of United States. So the gist of this book would be how the U.S. you know play a role in the maintenance of the monarchy in Thailand from the 19th century until the 21st century.
I am excited to read that. I recently read the book, the newer book on the American Cold War policies and Buddhism in Thailand. And just the way in which the United States supports the monarchy in the Cold War. So that sounds fascinating. I look forward to that.
Thank you.
Yeah. So thank you so much for your time. Maybe we'll get you back on here and talk about the next book in a few months.
Hopefully, if it's out.
So thank you again. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much.
This has been a conversation with Pavan Chaphalpongpong about his edited volume, Ku King Crisis, A Critical Interregnum, out in 2021 with Yale Southeast Asian Studies. I'm Michael Vann of Sacramento State University, and this has been an episode in New Books in History, a channel on the New Books Network. Thank you for listening.